All right, so over the last couple of years, one of the things that I've been doing a lot more is studying with skeptics and atheists. And what I want to do in this lesson is share some of the things that I've learned that I share with the people that I'm studying with. And the reason that I want to do this is because I think it gives us another tool for evangelism, but this lesson is not just here's how you teach some people. I think the more and more that secularism can creep into the heart of God's people, anytime we can be reminded or encouraged in a different way to kind of go back and redirect ourselves to God, that this can just be an encouragement for all of us as well. So this lesson has got several purposes for why I'm doing this. But I'll explain and I'll kind of build up to how I study with skeptics whenever I do that. Let me first of all start out by saying a few things about the culture that we live in. The statistic, I'm going to show you some statistics about religion in the United States. And these are statistics for the United States. A lot of people have thought that religion is just going to die out, which it's doing that more and more in the United States, but not in other countries. So these statistics are from the United States. So the Pew Research Center posted an article in 2019, October of 2019, right before the Rona started to become, so to place that in your mind, I have a reason for saying that. The title of the article was, "In the United States, Decline of Christianity Continues at a Rapid Pace." And so what they found was that the religiously unaffiliated was 26%. And from 2009, 10-year difference, it was up from 17%. Now, who are the religiously unaffiliated? There's a range of like more extreme religiously unaffiliated to more tame religiously unaffiliated. But there's atheists, and there's agnostics, and then there are people that are just indifferent. And so this is something that's growing more and more in the United States. And at 2 years later, which was just recently, the Gallup poll recently did another thing that said that for the first time, less than 50% of Americans belong to a church. And so you think about the first one being, this was in 2019. This one was in 2021, just really a few months ago, actually. So over the course of the last 2 years, religion is even more on a decline. And so this is part of the culture that we live in. What's the reason for this? Why is it that in the United States, but it's not true in China, it's not true in Africa, why is it the case that religion is on the decline in this country, but it's not in other places? Maybe people would say that there's some things with the education system that seem to go against all those different sorts of things. There's a lot of answers that you could say to this. But for a long time, I think since the influence of the Enlightenment age, which the Enlightenment certainly brought a lot of nice things, we were able to figure out more things than we were able to before, that this belief that human ability and human reasoning, as it advances and it gets more and more sophisticated, we'll see less and less reason to ever need religion and to need God. And so one of the things that is interesting about the growing skepticism in our society, if you've ever talked to a skeptic, is they'll kind of take the stance from the backdrop of the Enlightenment that I am the objective one. I am the one who's actually looked at the evidence. And I understand the science, and I understand Darwinian evolution, and I have looked at all the data, and I know, but you have emotional reasons for why you believe in God, but we've kind of gotten rid of all that, we're very objective. Now, I would argue, and I do argue with the skeptics when I study with them, that to get rid of a Christian worldview is to adopt another set of beliefs that also require faith. Every belief system requires faith. You can't airtightly, like I can't prove Jesus to somebody like you can prove a math equation. We're dealing with historical things. Like how do you prove something from history? You use different kind of proofs. But to suggest that me as Mr. Atheist, I'm totally objective in my rationale, and that's why I came to this unbelief in God. Is this not true? When I study with the skeptics, one of the things that I do is I've read from a lot of atheists. and I clip quotes from the books that I read, and I use these for the discussions to try to get the foot in the door to see if they'll open up the Bible. Here's one quote from an atheist named Aldous Huxley, who explains that he has some emotional reasons for why he does not believe in God. He said this in 1937, his book Ends and Means. The philosopher who finds no meaning in the world... Now, what he means by that is there's no transcendent meaning, there's no God, so it's a meaningless philosophy. That there's no ultimate transcendent meaning. That's what he's saying there. So, the philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in metaphysics. In other words, people who reach the conclusion that the world is meaningless because there's no God, they're not just only concerned with the science and data. There's other things driving these conclusions, and he says he is also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation, sexual and political. So here he's saying, yes, I've reached this conclusion that the world is meaningless, there's no transcendent God that gives us some kind of meaning outside of what I think is right or wrong for me, and all these different sorts of things. That it's not just, I'm just driven by the data and the metaphysics and the science and all this kind of stuff. I'm also concerned morally that I want to be able to do what I want to do. Now that's one emotional reason for unbelief. There's other ones. Whenever I sit down and I study with the skeptics, we sit around a big table at a coffee shop. And the first thing that I always do whenever we first meet is I say, okay, I'm a Christian. I think Christianity is reasonable. How do the rest of you guys identify yourself? And some of them will say, well, I'm a secular humanist. I'm a atheist. I'm an agnostic. You know, they kind of go around the room and talk about all of this. And one of the follow-up questions that I have is, okay, what made you a secular humanist? What made you an agnostic? What made you an atheist? And 9 times out of 10, there's some bitterness that comes out of their mouth. And they say, well, I grew up in a hypocritical Christian family. Or I was part of this denomination or that denomination, and a bunch of people were really mean and all this kind of stuff. And it's like there's these emotions that surface, which kind of shows that the thing that started your unbelief was not objective reasoning. Instead, what it was an emotional reaction to something that bothered you, that was in the ballpark of religion. And now you're frustrated, and you started going to all these other people like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. You started reading all these people to give legitimacy to your unbelief and makes it seem like it's objective. Everybody has emotional reasons for why they believe what they believe. That's just part of being a human. And we're not all Spock. And so Christianity, we have emotional reasons for why we believe, but so does the skeptic and so does the atheist. So it's kind of a wash to try to make that into some kind of big point, but it's important for the modern skeptic to know what are your emotional reasons for why you don't believe. But okay, so imagine that you're going to sit across the table from a group of skeptics and atheists who don't believe in God. They don't believe that the Bible is reliable. How do you approach them? And the first time I ever did a study with the skeptics and atheists in Atlanta is I came in the first study with all of the reasons why the resurrection happened. It's powerful stuff, by the way. But I realized that we were like two ships passing each other and not really understanding each other. Because what I started to realize in those conversations is that if I'm coming with objective reasons why you should believe in God, but deep down they have emotional reasons why they don't believe in God, am I really meeting them where they're at? This is one of the problems, and I'm not against traditional apologetics. You know, like here's the arguments for God, here's the arguments for the Bible. You've got to get there with people. People have got to see those things. But if you're going to study with a modern skeptic today, I don't think that's the place to start anymore. You've got to deal with the emotional barriers first to unbelief. And then after those emotional barriers have been cleared away, then yes, let's talk about why the Bible's reliable. Let's look at the archaeological evidence for the Scriptures. Let's see the logical arguments for the existence of God. Let's look at those things after the emotional barriers have been moved away. So the approach that I take with the skeptics when I study with them now is to show why they should have an interest in Christianity being true. That Christianity fits, like the sermon title, Christianity fits your deepest needs. That there's things that you know you need, And Christianity just seems to fit it perfectly like a glove. Which doesn't become like an airtight argument for Christianity. What it does is it shows you that, look, the things that the Scripture says, it actually resonates more with you than you realize. And maybe what you're thinking the Scripture says is really your bad experience with different people. But when it comes to the things that deep down you know you need, what we'll do is we'll compare the secular worldview, and I'll quote a bunch of atheists for the discussions. I'll say, this is what these atheists said about finding these things that we know we need, and here's what the Bible says about it. Which one makes better sense to you emotionally? And that's what I'm about to do. So if all of that went like, whoo, I'm about to do this with four examples. And so let's go ahead. So after I set up this whole idea with them that that you've got emotional reasons for unbelief, I've got emotional reasons for belief. So the way forward is, let's compare worldviews. You've got secularism, I got Christianity. Let's talk about the things that every human knows that they need, and which worldview gives the better resources to fulfill those needs. That's the question. So the first one is our need for meaning. Everybody knows that they need to have some sense of meaning. It seems kind of inherent to humanity that we would like to know why we're here, that what we do is going to last beyond our lifetime. We want to have some kind of sense of meaning. And many secularists, atheists, agnostics, skeptics, things like that, have argued that without God there is no objective meaning. There's no God giving us some kind of objective meaning. Here's one quote from Stephen Jay Gould, who says this: "We are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. Because the earth never froze entirely during an ice age, we may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We must construct these answers for ourselves." You see what he's saying here? He's saying that, you know, why are we here? Everybody wants to know why we're here. This was, by the way, in the Life magazine, and they had I think it was in 1988. You can find like all the articles from this magazine online somewhere. But it was a magazine that asked a bunch of famous people, what's the meaning in life? And Stephen Jay Gould, this was his answer, this is part of his answer, that you guys all want to know why we're here? Well, it's because a fish was able to fin its way up somehow, and it got lucky in how it was able to do that. And there's also another time where the earth almost froze entirely, but the extremophiles, those little bugs that can like live in extreme conditions, they somehow lived and then they were able to grow into what we have today and everything like that. That's the answer. So, but... look at how he still has an approach to finding meaning. This is important. Should a Christian look at a quote like this and go, that's right, no meaning, blah, blah, blah. No, look at the rest of what he says. We still try to find meaning in life. It's still like this thing that I know I need. But the way that we find meaning in life is we construct these answers for ourselves. How common is that today? Yeah, there's no God, there's no transcendent meaning in that way, but I get to figure out what my life is all about. So my life is going to be about traveling, and my life is going to be about intellect, and my life is going to be about family, and it's going to be all sunsets and all these cool, beautiful things. People will have different things that they try to make their meaning in life. Do you know what the problem with this is? If you're constructing your own meaning, if you're constructing your own meaning in life, it's confined to this life. And this life is extremely fragile. You realize that, let's say that I make my meaning in life my family. I have four beautiful children, a wonderful wife. One car accident can take all of them away. If my meaning in life is my family, I derive a lot of joy from having a family, and we should. But if my meaning in life is built on that, you realize how fragile it is. If my meaning in life is my career, you realize that you could be fired so easily and so quickly if you just say the wrong thing in our culture right now. There's so many things that are so fragile in this world. One of the biggest problems with trying to construct your own meaning in life is that it's confined to this life, and any kind of suffering could just take it away. What is it that Christianity offers with regards to meaning in life? Well, first of all, we're made in God's image. Looking like part of meaning is looking back, like what are my origins? You're made in God's image. Everybody's made in God's image. Have you ever noticed, by the way, that in the Bible, God will say, don't make any graven images of me. Make no graven images. Did you know that that same Hebrew word for make no graven images of God is also used in Genesis chapter 1, that God made man in his own image? Does God have images?
Yeah. What if I tried to make an image of God and it was a bull? Like big horns and everything like that. It's just one picture of something and it just represents strength.
Would a bull represent love and compassion? Well, what if my image of God is going to be a bunny rabbit? Because it's soft and fluffy and I can kind of control it. Like, that's how I'd like to think of God. God made something that can adequately image him. And it's a human being. Of all the things God made, human beings are the vessel that have been dignified with the ability to represent the king. That's high privilege. And so it's not just that we our origins are not that we evolved from all these things and there's really no purpose, that we are the most dignified thing God made. And the things that we do have an eternal impact. We can help other people get connected to this God and to this cosmic king so that they can be with him forever. So that when I'm helping people, I'm not just helping people in a political way or something and that's going to be done as soon as this nation's destroyed. I can help people for eternity. And can suffering ever take the Christian away from that purpose? We just saw in the book of Job, you still serve God. 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 and 21. What credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you've been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. For the Christian, when we suffer, we're driven deeper into our purpose. And every time we lose something in this life, it reminds us and it causes us to yearn for the afterlife. Sufferings of this life never take us away from our meaning, which is more satisfying. Notice the next one, our need for identity. All of us have different hats that we wear. So like, I'm a husband, I'm a father, I'm a preacher, I don't know why I said that. But like, I'm a brother, cousin, you know, whatever. So we have different hats that we wear. And depending on what hat I'm wearing at the moment, we might act a little different to adjust to the... And that doesn't mean we're being hypocritical. That just means that I'm fulfilling a certain role right now. Your identity is what is identical about you in every hat you wear. That's your identity. Who are you at the core? Who are you? And there's traditional ways of understanding what your identity is, and there's more modern approach. The traditional approach to identity is that you start from the outside and work it in. So let me show you how this works. Imagine that you grew up in the 1500s, and your dad was a farmer. What's expected of you? That you be a farmer. But what if you're like, well, I want to be a painter, or I want to be something else. I don't know. I want to fix camels for a living. And if you say, I want to do that, you have to kind of stuff that feeling, and you have to go, well, everybody's expecting me to do this, so I've got to lay aside what I would like to do and just accept what everybody around me is telling me to do. Now, the modern approach is the exact opposite. It works from the inside out. Where I start with, well, this is who I am, and y'all better accept it. And if you don't, we're going to make a loud ruckus about it. By the way, the brilliant, brilliant movie Frozen, 2013, still seems so modern. The song with Elsa, Let It Go, you guys all know that song, right? Do you know that this song switches from the outside in approach to the inside out approach? So part of the song, I won't sing this, but Elsa says, don't let them in, don't let them see, be the good girl you always have to be, conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. What is she saying here? There's things about me that if everybody else found out that I thought these ways or I wanted these things, I would be out. I would be ousted. How would people think about me? And so she's really doomy and gloomy and all these kinds of things. But then the song becomes so beautiful. And when the song becomes beautiful and the colors change and all this kind of stuff, it says, well, now they know. Let it go, can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're going to say. Like when the song gets really upbeat, you know what she's moving from? She's moving from the traditional approach to understanding who I am that I better toe the line of what everybody expects of me. So now, I'm going to be true to myself and I'm going to be who I want to be. And that's what it means to let it go. Let it go what they all think about me. So you're moving from the traditional to the modern. By the way, there's problems with both of these approaches. But this is good for our context right now. This is what kind of what we're living in right now. And so what's the problem with this approach? Because this is the one that we're living in. We could deconstruct the traditional approach, and there's problems with that one, but this is our culture. So what's problematic with this modern approach? There's a couple things to think about with that. Number one is it's pretty unreliable. If someone wants to pursue a career, like we've got different competing desires. So, for example, let's say that I want to have a really good career, but I also want to have a family. Could some people emphasize career above their family and lose their family in the process? So, what if I've got competing desires? How do I know how to be true to myself? Because it seems like every couple of months my desires are changing. I think that's kind of part of the human condition. And so we've got that as a problem, but maybe another problem with this is that this is kind of an illusion. If I want to be true to myself as a Christian today, can I be true to myself as a Christian and pronounce my beliefs about all the moral things in our society right now and everybody accept me? Well, people say, you're being so brave being true to yourself, Mr. Christian, quoting Romans chapter 1 and Leviticus 18. We all love you for how brave you're being. No, that's never going to happen. And so maybe this modern approach in some ways is sort of like the traditional approach where people are saying, be true to yourself, but only in these ways, not in these other ways. So there's problems with that, but here's the question then. What does Christianity offer that's unique? Maybe the most succinct passage in the Bible with regards to a Christian understanding his or her identity. 1 Corinthians 4, in the context, the first four chapters of 1 Corinthians, Paul is reasoning with the Corinthians who are having their favorite preachers and teachers. It's not just what their preference is. It's like we're going to fight and divide over who our favorite preachers are. And so Paul is writing these first four chapters to help the Corinthians understand that this is how you ought to think about preachers. And this is one of the things that he says here. But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself. For I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I am not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. Alright, notice what Paul does here. He rejects both the traditional and the modern approach to identity. He says here, it's a very small thing that I should be judged by you guys. You Corinthians who are saying that you don't like me, but you like these other preachers, whatever. I don't really care what you guys think about that. And you might expect him to go, I don't care what you think about me. I only care what I think about me. But instead, he says here, I'm not aware of anything against myself in verse 4. In other words, my conscience isn't bothering me. I feel pretty good about me right now, is what he's saying. But what does that still mean? Does that mean that I'm totally innocent before God? Like, there could be things I'm not aware of. So he says, I don't care what you think about me. I don't even care what I think about me. The only thing that matters is what the Lord says about me. And in the lesson yesterday, one of the lessons that we dealt with regards to identity, all the things that God calls the Christian in Ephesians 1 through 3, that you are a saint, you are chosen, you're adopted, you're predestined, you're all these different things, you're loved, you're God's workmanship. God's idea of who you are is what ought to define us. All of us need some kind of an affirmation from outside of us. It doesn't work with other people, but it does work with the transcendent God. And so, our emotions are far too fickle for us to determine who I am. So this approach doesn't work. So here's the third need, is our need for morality. Everybody, whether you're atheist, Christian, whatever, everybody would believe in moral obligation, which is different from like what your favorite flavor of ice cream is. Like, I like vanilla with Snickers or whatever. And you might like something totally different, and we're not going to fight about it. What if somebody said, well, racism is wrong for me, but if you're okay with it, then that's fine. Nobody would say that, and nobody should say that. We all have this idea that there are things that apply to me and apply to everybody. And that we should do something about people that are doing something against those kinds of things. And so the secular person, Christians need to be careful when they're talking to atheists that, oh, you guys have no reason for morality. Well, bottom line, that is kind of true. But do they try to find some reasons to care about morality? And would it be helpful to know what their reasons are? How they try to derive a sense of morality? Why they care about morality? So the argument is not, can atheists be moral? Yeah, atheists can do morally good things. They can give to the needy and all this kind of stuff. The question is, what's your basis for doing it? Why do you care about it to begin with? By the way, whenever I try to reason with the skeptics, that your worldview requires a lot of faith, this is one of the things, this is my, one of my favorite examples to bring up. That so many people in our society right now say that they care about social justice, all these different sorts of things. And my question to them is, that's great. I'm glad that you care about justice. We all should. My question to you is, why do you care about it? Because if you go back and read Charles Darwin, what he said in his book, The Descent of Man, is that he calls people from Australia and Africa, he calls them anthropomorphous apes. And that the white people will kill them. And that those people will be taken off the planet. That's what he says in his book, The Descent of Man. And so, how can you come from Darwinian evolution and say that you care about equal human rights when it's incoherent to your worldview? You're believing a lot of things by faith right now. The Christian worldview has got a far better answer to this. But so here's the question. How does the skeptic derive how they care about morality? One, sometimes they'll say, well, morality has come about from naturalistic evolution. That we've kind of, you can kind of observe in animals that some animals care for other animals. You kind of see some altruistic sort of things that they do for each other. And as the chain went up, eventually it got to a heightened sense with human beings. Thomas Nagel is an atheist. And he wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos. And he's an atheist who's showing why evolution is no longer a plausible theory. And one of his arguments that he said in this book, that's one point, that the strong eating the weak is inconsistent with altruism. But here's what Thomas Nagel says. If evolutionary biology is a physical theory, as it is generally taken to be, then it cannot account for the appearance of consciousness and other phenomena that are not physically reducible. You see his point here? That evolution is just a physical theory. It's just chemicals reacting. So how can you get things that seem non-physical or non-material, like value judgments and the cosmos and the conscience and the mind and how it works? How can you have a physical theory that creates an immaterial thing? It can't do that. So there's a skeptic that's making that. So that argument doesn't work, that morality comes from evolution. But here's another one, is that people will say that morality comes from social consensus. If this society says that this is what we believe or whatever, there's obvious problems with that. Nazi Germany, a lot of them believed what they were doing was okay. 1,000 years ago, most societies believed slavery was okay. Does that mean that it was right for them in their day? No, it doesn't. So that's an easier one to kind of attack. But what is it that Christianity offers? Why is it that we care about morality? What's the basis for it? Which, by the way, sometimes people will say, really, you're going to bring this up? Because Christians are really hypocritical. Like, Christianity has better resources to be moral when you guys are a bunch of hypocrites? Is everybody ever totally consistent with their worldview? The skeptic is sure not consistent with their worldview. They care about social justice and stuff like that. It doesn't come from their worldview. It comes from the Christian worldview. Are Christians always consistent with their worldview? No. Nobody is. And so the question is, what worldview gives the better resource to be concerned with morality? What Christianity offers is a clear sense of purpose. We talked about being made in God's image. All right, here's the clickatizer. So imagine that I took the clickatizer and I used it to start hammering nails, to use it as a hammer. And the clickatizer shatters, whatever, this is the clicker, I guess. It shatters, and I go, this is a terrible hammer. And I go call Logitech, and I say, you guys make terrible hammers. And they say, we make clickatizers, what are you talking about? And I say, I tried using it, well, that's not what its purpose is. This is interesting. How can a skeptic, a secular person, have any idea of who a good person and a bad person is when you don't even know why we're here? You can't know if something's good or bad unless you've got some sense of its purpose. So Christianity has a clear purpose. You're made in God's image. Your mission is to image God and reflect His character. So for the Christian, morality comes and flows from his character. We are holy because he's holy. We've got clear directions in all of those kinds of ways, and so we don't have as many problems coming up with answers to these questions. All right, so that's our need for morality. The last one is our need for hope. All of us live the present in light of what we believe about the future. And so... hope, if you don't have a lot of hope, there's going to be a lot of depression, there's going to be a lot of frustration, there's going to be a lot of suicide, things like that. Things that have been growing more and more in our country right now, actually. So our society's not doing a very good job of instilling hope. But what is the secular approach to having like a bright outlook on the future? One thing that they'll say is that they hope to make the world a better place. We talked about this a little bit yesterday in the Ecclesiastes lesson. But they want to somehow make some kind of contribution to the world, and we talked about this yesterday, that Ecclesiastes 1:15 says, "What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted." I used this illustration yesterday, but there's some of you that weren't here yesterday, so I'll use it again. If your worldview says that this planet's going to be destroyed and burned up and humanity is just going to all end one day, why are you concerned with making the world a better place? Where's the world going? Nowhere. So, imagine again that you're on an airplane and it's going to crash, but you've got a few minutes before it crashes. So you go to the bathroom, and when you go to the bathroom on the plane, you find that the light's not working in the bathroom, and then you go to the steward person after you go to the bathroom, and you go, "The light's not working! We've got to fix the light! This is a big deal!" On a plane that's going to crash. People that get all concerned about all kinds of things in this life, when their worldview says it's all going to be destroyed anyway, why do you care? You've got no basis to care. I'm glad that you do, but you've got no basis for it. So some people will say that's their sense of hope. My hope is that I get to leave the world a better place. Another one is that you accept death as a natural part of life. I just finished a book by an atheist a couple weeks ago. And she said in the book that, all right, my hope is I just learn to accept that death is a natural part of life. This is just kind of what happens. But here's my hope, is that when I die and my body decomposes, that I can be planted with a seed for an oak tree. And that oak tree can grow one day, and somebody can hang a swing on the oak tree and some kids can play on it. Does that sound satisfying? In Washington State, where Seattle is, they just passed a law that you can bury the remains of somebody like with a plant, like to help feed the plant. That's kind of influenced by some of this ideology. But you almost have to kill part of the way that you think about things. Like we have an adverse reaction, but more people are saying, well, you just got to accept it, and your hope is that you get to be part of this circle of life like Mufasa and Simba talk about. Disney's got a lot of rich things in it. All right. So what's the... That's not satisfying. All right. I mean, this is not. Some of the movies... Disney... Or Lion King's pretty good, but some naturalistic thinking in it. Okay. The Christian approach. 1 Thessalonians 4:16 and 17. "For the Lord Himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the voice of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. So we will always be with the Lord." Notice in this, the dead in Christ, we will be caught up. In Buddhism and pantheistic religions, when you die, you go like back to the all soul. You're like a dewdrop going back into the ocean. So you lose your individuality and you get absorbed into something else. The biblical worldview of our hope is that you still get to be you. You still get to be you, but perfected. And our community still gets to be our community. In verse 7, that we get to be caught up with them in the clouds. So the afterlife involves a great reunion of the people of whom the world was not worthy, like Hebrews 11 talks about. Good company. But not just that, in verse 17, that you get to always be with the Lord. Now, I don't think what humanity wants is to simply exist after they die. We want love after death. People that go to hell for eternity, they have consciousness forever. They have some kind of life after death, but it's not, the quality's not good. What we have with God is we get to be with the God of all love forever. We want love after death. The God of all comfort, the light of the world, the good shepherd, the refuge for the oppressed, the perfect Father, the God of peace, the God of grace, He's our Redeemer. All these different things that God is described as in the Bible, all pointing to this idea that He's a benevolent, loving God. And this is who you get to be with forever. Now, a couple weeks ago when I studied this topic. So I have a discussion. We do one discussion for each of these things on morality, identity, hope, and everything. So the most recent one that we did was hope. And this was the fifth class that we had done. Is we kept saying, okay, so is that very satisfying that you're going to plant, be a plant one day and all these different sorts? And they're like, no, we feel like we're not really made for that kind of thing. And they got kind of frustrated and they said, look, we understand that Christianity has better answers to these things. And I got them right where I want them right now. Because they at least see the beauty of Christianity. Does any of this prove Christianity? No, it doesn't prove it. But what it does is it shows you that just maybe you were designed by somebody who knows your psychology. And he knows what you need. And you keep bumping up against these things. And you're trying to come up with sophisticated answers as to how you derive morality, but you know that these things don't work. God gives you the better resources for the things that you know you need. Now, do you need to know all of these atheists that I quoted from in order to have conversations like this with people? What you can do is every time a skeptic or some kind of an atheist person that you're talking with, somebody you know in school or work, every time they make a value judgment about something, that's good, that's bad, that person's a good person, oh, how do you know? Just attack the value judgments and the value statements in a gentle way. How did you come to that conclusion? What makes you think that's good? How do you base things that are good or bad? Why do you think that this is a thing that we should be pursuing? What made you get to these conclusions? Just ask those kinds of questions and think about the value judgments that they're making. I hope, at least for all of us here this morning, that we're reminded that Christianity makes better sense than any other worldview. Maybe you're here and you're struggling to think, you know, seems like there's a lot of powerful ideas in this world, and it seems like Christianity's kind of like a dinosaur. It's old and antiquated. This is as modern as anything you could find, and it's more relevant than anything you could find. If there's anybody here that has any needs, or they're needing to be encouraged to come back to God, to make God the center of their life, we're about to sing this song, Have You Been to Jesus for the Cleansing Power? Are you trusting in that? Is that something that you're relying in? He's the only source of absolution that you can find. If there's anybody that needs any help, please come forward while we stand, while we sing.